Chapter 9. When Jack Aubrey brought his ship into the fleet at the rendezvous southeast of Toulon, she had 3 turns of 12-inch cable frapped about her, and a spare spritsail thick with tarred oakum drawn under her bottom. She had something of the chrysalis look her captain had once imagined in the lightness of his heart, but at least she still possessed her masts and all her guns, though they had cost her people some cruel days of pumping, and at least she looked trim and clean as she glided cautiously in over a perfect sea, the deep, deep blue rippling under the caress of a languid southern breeze. The water still gushed in steady jets from her side, but she was no longer in danger of foundering. The Worcester came in at such a gentle pace that Jack had plenty of time to survey the squadron. Some ships were missing, either because they had been sent to Malta to refit, or because they had not yet rejoined. But on the other hand, 2 74s and an 80-gun ship had arrived from Cadiz, and at least some stores must have reached the fleet, since there were now only 6 jury-masts to be seen. The squadron, though battered and somewhat diminished, was still a powerful blockading force. He saw that, clearly enough, from a distance, and when his barge pulled along the line in answer to the flagship's signal, he saw it more clearly still. On this calm, sunny day, the ships all had their ports open to air the lower decks, and behind these ports he saw the guns, row after row of guns, with seamen titivating them. This sense of abiding strength and his exact falling in with a squadron was a satisfaction to him, but the greater part of his mind was taken up with foreboding and concern. As the barge slipped along past the ocean's splendid gilded stern, he heard the howling of the admiral's little dog, and when Bondon hooked on at the entry port, blundering for the first time in his life as captain's coxswain, Jack was obliged to compose himself for an instant before going aboard. The ceremony of reception was muted. On all hands he saw faces as grave as his own, and the admiral's secretary, leading him to the forecabin, said in a low voice, "When I take you in, pray let the interview be as short and smooth as possible. He has had a long, hard day of it. Dr. Harrington is with him now." They stood there for a while, looking out through the half-port, beyond the dark rectangle, to the brilliance and purity of the day, even purer and more brilliant for being framed. And still the dog howled.
"The doctor is with him," reflected Jack. "So they have put the pug into the coach. Some dogs cannot bear seeing their masters touched."
The ocean veered a quarter of a point, and now the frame contained a ship, a great way off and apparently floating above the nacreous surface of the farther sea. As seamen will, Jack tilted his head back and sideways to consider her. She was surprise, of course, and she was presumably coming from the inshore squadron. Yet her side was painted blue, and what little he could make out of her pennant showed it as low as the cross-trees. The ship was in mourning.
"What has happened to Captain Latham?" he asked.
"Can you indeed see as far as that?" said Alan, following his gaze. "I'm afraid he was killed. He and his first lieutenant were killed by the same ball as the Surprise was going down to attack the Robuste."
Dr. Harrington came out of the great cabin, bowed and sombre. He opened the coach door as he went by, and the little dog, scrambling fast across the deck, darted in before Jack and the secretary and flung itself down under the admiral's desk. Jack had expected to find the admiral deeply saddened, even more infirm, possibly savage. He could be a Tartar on occasion, certainly very gravely affected indeed, but he had not expected to find him removed from humanity, and it disconcerted him. Admiral Thornton was perfectly civil and collected. He congratulated Aubrey on having brought the Worcester in, listened to a brief summary of the statement of condition that Jack laid on his desk, and said the ship must clearly go to Malta for a complete refit. She would be of no use as a man of war for a great while, if at all, but her guns would be uncommonly useful at this juncture. His mind was alive. It dealt with the details of his command, rarely hesitating for a moment, but the man was not, or not wholly, and he looked at Jack from an immense distance, not coldly, still less severely, but from another plane, and Jack felt more and more embarrassed, ashamed of being alive while the other was already taking leave.
"But in the meantime, Aubrey," said the admiral, you will not be idle. As you may have heard, poor Latham was killed in his engagement with the Robuste, so you will proceed to the Seven Islands in surprise. The death of one of the Turkish rulers on the Ionian coast has brought about a complex situation that may possibly allow us to expel the French from Marga, even from Paxo and Corfu, and we must have at least one frigate on the spot. I will not elaborate. I am leaving this station very shortly, you know. But Mr. Allen will make the position clear, and the Rear Admiral will give you your orders. You will have the advice of Dr. Maturin and Mr. Graham. Does that suit you?
Yes, sir.
Then goodbye to you, Aubrey,
said the Admiral, holding out his hand. Yet it was not a human farewell. It was rather a gesture of civility to a being of another kind, very small and far away, at the wrong end of a telescope, as it were, a being of no importance, in circumstances of no great importance, that nevertheless had to be dealt with correctly. Only twice had Jack felt that the Admiral was still in contact with the ordinary world. Once, when he gently put his foot on the pug's back to stop it wheezing so loud, and once when he said, "Leaving this station?" It was common knowledge that the ocean was sailing for Mahon and Gibraltar in the morning, but the Admiral's meaning would have been clear to a man with even less religious sense than Jack Aubrey, and the tone of unaffected humility and resignation moved him deeply. Returning to the fore cabin, he found Stephen there with Mr. Allen and Professor Graham.
"Captain Aubrey," said Stephen, "I have been telling Mr. Allen that I must decline going with you to Admiral Hart's apartment. There are circumstances that make it improper for me to make any official appearance in this matter, or in any other to do with intelligence at present."
"I quite agree," said Graham.
"Besides," added Stephen, "I have to see Dr. Harrington and our patient in 15 minutes.
"Very well," said Allen.
"Then I shall send a messenger to tell Dr. Harrington that you are here. Gentlemen, shall we wait on the Rear Admiral?"
Rear Admiral Hard had never held an independent command of any importance, and the prospect of supporting the enormous responsibilities of Commander-in-Chief in the Mediterranean overwhelmed him. Although it was certain that the Admiralty would not leave him in a post so very far beyond his abilities, but would send out a replacement as soon as the news of Admiral Thornton's incapacity reached London, Hart's manner and even his appearance were almost unrecognisable. His ill-looking, foxy, close-eyed face wore a look that Jack had never seen on it before, although they were old, old acquaintances, a look of earnest gravity. He was civil to Jack and almost deferential to Allen and Graham, who for their part treated him with no extraordinary respect. Hart had at no time been admitted to the Admiral's confidence in anything but purely naval matters. He knew almost nothing of the deeply involved political situation, and nothing whatsoever about the Admiral's frail network of intelligence. Allen gave a short account of the position in the Seven Islands, and Hart could be seen straining his weak understanding to follow it.
"Now, sir," said Allen, "I advert not to the Seven Islands as such, but to their former allies and dependencies on the mainland, particularly Kutali and Marga. As you know, the French are still in Marga, and they seem to be as firmly settled there as they are in Corfu. Yet a little while ago it was represented to the Commander-in-Chief that the possessor of Kutali could cut Marga's aqueduct and take the town from behind, while a friendly base at Kutali would make it far easier for us to attack Paxo and Corfu, which even Bonaparte calls the keys of the Adriatic."
"We are to take Kutali, then?" said Hart.
"Why, no, sir," said Allen patiently. "Kutali is Turkish, and we must not offend the pot. Any evident, unprovoked aggression in this region would give our enemies in Constantinople a great advantage. It must never be forgotten that the French have some very intelligent men there, that the Sultan's mother is a Frenchwoman, and that Napoleon's recent successes have very much strengthened the French party. But it so happens that the town, which, as you will recall, was an independent Christian republic before the Treaty of Pressburg, lies between three ill-defined beyliks, and its status has not yet been finally decided in Constantinople. The former governor, whose recent death brought this crisis about, was to hold office only while the town's position, its privileges, and so on, were considered. It is a valuable place,
The neighbouring rulers covet it exceedingly, and two of them, Ismail and Mustafa, have already approached us for help, while the agent of the third is thought to be in Malta at present.
"What kind of help do they want?"
asked Hart. "Guns, sir, and gunpowder."
"Guns!" cried Hart, looking at the others.
But he said no more, and when first Alan and then Graham explained that in the outlying provinces of the Turkish Empire the Valis, Pashas, Agas, and Beys, though in principle subject to the Sultan, often behaved like independent rulers, increasing their territories by usurpation or by making open war upon one another, he looked displeased.
"Ali Arslan of Yanina defeated and killed the Pasha of Scutari not long since," said Graham. "It is true that Scutari had rebelled, but the same cannot be said for the Derwent Pasha of Rumelia, nor of Minoglu Bey."
"The independence increases with the distance from Constantinople," said Alan. "In Algiers, for example, it is virtually complete, but here it is usually exercised with a certain discretion. They often go to war with one another, but they generally do so with cries of loyalty to the Sultan, for although the pot will acquiesce in a fait accompli if it is accompanied by the proper offerings, a reasonably good case still has to be made out. The defeated man must be shown to have had treacherous intentions or to have been in correspondence with the enemy."
"And except in cases where the Pasha or Vali throws off his allegiance and goes about to cut himself out a completely sovereign state, as Scutari and Pasanvoglu did not long ago, and as Ali Pasha will almost certainly do as soon as he can be sure of the Moria, except in cases of total rebellion, I say, the Sultan's direct appointment is respected in these parts, when at last it is forthcoming in the form of an irade, or firman," said Graham. "The Sultan's irade is sacred except to rebels."
"That is why all three beys also have their agents busy in Constantinople, jockeying for position," said Alan, "though to be sure they expect to settle matters much more briskly by themselves, so that the fact of possession and the increased wealth of possession may plead in their favour. Unfortunately, one of them has also seen fit to make interest with our embassy, which may complicate our task. For whereas the commander-in-chief inclines towards Mustafa as a seaman and a former acquaintance— they knew one another when Mustafa was in the Dardanelles— the embassy favours Ismail."
"Who holds the place at present?" asked Jack.
"The third man, old Sayahan Bey. That is to say, he is sitting quietly in the lower town and the suburbs. The Christians, the Kutaliotes, hold the citadel unmolested. For the moment there is an uneasy truce, no one of the three Turks daring to attack for fear of meeting a coalition of the other two, and the Christians biding their time. But the position will change the moment the cannon arrive." Hart stared for a while and then said,
"So they mean to fight one another, and we are to supply the guns. What do the various sides offer in exchange?"
"Their promises are the same. They will turn the guns against the French in Marga. Having settled us in Kutali, they will join in our attack on Marga, the place being taken before there is time for the French party in Constantinople to interfere."
"I see. Are the guns available?"
"Yes, sir. Two small transports have been prepared and are lying in Valletta. The trouble is we do not know which of the claimants to trust. Ismail openly states that General Donzelo, the commander of Corfu, has made him offers, but this may merely be intended to raise his price. Mustafa says nothing of the kind, but we have a certain amount of intelligence to show that he too may be in contact with the French. So bearing these things in mind, sir, and taking into account the necessity for rapid action, it was thought advisable to send Captain Aubrey with a political adviser to view the situation, to meet the Beys, to make up his mind on the spot, and, if possible, to carry out the operation."
"Just so," said Hart.
"Perhaps it would be as well to couch the orders in the most general sense, leaving a great deal of room for discretion?"
"Certainly, certainly. Just put, use his best endeavours, together with a general statement of the aim of the operation, and leave it at that. Do not tie his hands. Does that suit you, Aubrey?"
"If it don't, just say the word, and the orders shall be wrote to your dictation. I can't say fairer than that." Jack bowed, and there was a short silence. "Then there is this point of the surprises crew, sir," said Alan. "In view of the death of Captain Latham and his first lieutenant, the commander-in-chief thought you would agree that the best way of dealing with the situation would be to disperse the entire ship's company in small groups throughout the squadron and reman the frigate from the ships that have to go in to refit."
"God damn me," said Hart, I should hang the mutinous buggers if I had my own way, every last one of them. But with both chief witnesses dead, I suppose it must be so.
Since Worcester must go in, said Jack, I could pick an excellent frigate's crew from her people alone, men who are used to working together. Several old surprises among them.
Make it so, Aubrey. Make it so, said Hart. And in the same tone of awkward goodwill, he continued,
Of course, you will have to have a sloop of some kind in company for this sort of expedition. If you like, I will try to let you have Babington in the Dryad.
Thank you very much, sir, said Jack. I should like that of all things.
I should like that of all things, said I, with a winning leer and a bob of my head, wrote Jack Aubrey in his letter home, a letter dated from Surprise at Sea. But I hope, sweetheart, you will not think me ungenerous or mean-spirited when I say I do not trust him. That is to say, I do not trust the long continuance of his goodwill. If I choose the wrong man among these bays, or if the operations do not go well, I think he will throw me to the dogs without the least hesitation, and William Babington after me. Stephen don't trust him neither.
He paused, and reflecting that he could not very well describe his friend's vehement refusal to appear in the character of an intelligence agent before
a man so weak, so choleric, so little master of his passions, and so likely to be indiscreet as Hart, even though the Rear Admiral might for the moment be acting Commander-in-Chief, he added,
Which is very sad.
But the words were no sooner written than they struck him as ludicrous, and he was so very far from sad himself that he laughed aloud.
"'What now?' called Killick angrily from the sleeping cabin.
He was one of the very few who disliked the move into the Surprise, and he had been in a most unpleasant temper ever since they left Malta. His immediate predecessor, Captain Latham's steward, a fornicating sodomite by the name of Hogg, had changed everything. Nothing was the same. The night locker, where Killick had always kept needle and thread for small repairs, had been moved from starboard to larboard. The midship's scuttle, under which he had always worked, had been blocked up and painted over. He could no longer find anything, nor could he see to sew.
"'I was only laughing,' said Jack.
"'If I had that hog under my needle now,' said Killick, giving the hem of Captain Aubrey's best neckcloth a vicious stab, "'wouldn't I learn him to laugh? Oh, no, not half I wouldn't.'
His voice diminished in volume, but his nasal whine had a curiously penetrating quality, and as Jack carried on with his letter, he half heard the stream of discontent flowing on.
Unhappy ship! No wonder! Everything changed! Acres of fucking brass! Closed up my scuttle! How can a poor unfortunate bugger see with no light? Sewing black upon black!
This last was so shrill that it quite broke in upon Jack's line of thought.
"'If you cannot see in there, carry it out into the stern gallery,' he called,
forgetting for a moment that they were no longer in the Worcester.
"'Which there ain't no stern gallery, sir. Now we've been degraded to a sixth rate,' cried Killick with malignant triumph. "'Stern galleries is for our bitches, and I must toil and moil away in the dark.'
"'Killick is in a horrid passion, I am sorry to say,' wrote Jack, "'and will not be comforted until we are back in a ship of the line. "'For my part, I do not care if I never see a ship of the line again. "'After these months of close blockade, a well-found frigate seems the ideal command to me, "'and I may say the same for all my officers. "'I am to dine with them today, and we are to have a grand poetic contest, "'a kind of sweepstake, to be judged by secret ballot.' "'Killick,' he called, "'Rouse out a glass of bitters, will you, and have one for yourself while you are about it.'
The gunroom's dinner was earlier than Jack's usual hour, and he wanted to do honour to their feast.
"'Which there ain't none left, sir,'
replied Killick, pleased for the first time that day.
"'Don't you remember the case dropped into the hold in consequence of the orlop scuttle had been shifted, which they never told us, and was stove? So there ain't none left.' "'All wasted, not even tasted, all gone into the bilge. "'All wasted, not even tasted, all gone into the bilge,' he repeated in a lugubrious chant.
"'Oh, well,' said Jack, "'I shall take a turn upon the quarter-deck. "'That will answer just as well.'
"'It answered even better, The hands had already eaten their dinner and drunk their grog, but the midshipmen's berth was rounding out their peas pudding and pig's trotters with toasted bloaters laid in at Valletta, and the smell eddying aft from the galley brought water to his mouth. Yet the bloaters were not really necessary. Happiness always gave Jack Aubrey an appetite, and at present he was filled with irrational glee. A glee that redoubled as he stood on that familiar quarter-deck, so much nearer to the sea than the Worcesters, and surveyed the noble spread of canvas that was urging the Surprise eastwards to her meeting with the Dryad at nearly 3 knots, in a breeze so faint that many ships would not have had steerage way, while at the same time he felt her supple lift and yield to the southern swell, a more living motion than that of any other ship he knew. His was largely an irrational happiness, and entirely on the surface. He had only to move down one layer in his mind to meet his very real distress for Admiral Thornton, one more for the shocking disappointment of the battle that had escaped them, a battle that might have ranked with St. Vincent or the Nile, and which would almost certainly have made Tom Pullings a commander, a move particularly near to Aubrey's heart. Another layer still for his own deeply worrying failure at Barca, and if he sank farther, there were always his legal and financial worries at home, and his anxiety about his father. The newspapers in Malta had spoken of General Aubrey's being returned for no less than 2 constituencies at once, and it appeared that the old gentleman was now twice as loquacious. He spoke against the ministry almost every day, and he was now doing so entirely in the more extreme radical interest, alas, a real embarrassment to the ministry. And there was not much room for rational glee if Jack looked forward either, but rather the prospect of an exceedingly difficult situation in which diplomacy rather than hard fighting would be called for, a situation in which he could rely on no support from his chief, a situation in which a mistaken choice might bring his naval career to an end. Yet gleeful he was. The tedium of blockade on short commons in a heavy, ill-contrived ship that might publicly disgrace herself at any minute was behind him, at least for the immediate future. The wearisome and in some ways painful transfer, the paperwork and the wrangling with the authorities in Malta was over. The Worcester, the walking corpse, was the dockyard's corporate anxiety, not his. And although he had left the oratorio behind him, he had also left the mumps, that fell disease. He had dispersed his more useless midshipmen and all his youngsters, but for 2, Calamy and Williamson, for whom he felt a particular responsibility. And he was aboard a thoroughbred frigate, a ship he knew through and through, and that he loved entirely, not only for her amiable qualities, but because she was part of his youth. Quite apart from the fact that he had commanded her in the Indian Ocean, where she had behaved quite beautifully, he had served in her long, long ago, and even the smell of her cramped and awkward midshipmen's berth made him feel young again. She was rather small, few smaller left in the service. She was rather old, and although she had been very much strengthened, almost rebuilt in the Cadiz yard, it would never, never do to take her across to meet the heavy Americans. But he had found to his delight that her refitting had not altered her sailing qualities in the least. She was astonishingly fast for those who knew how to handle her. She could come about like a cutter, and she could eat the wind out of any ship on the station. For this kind of mission, and for the Eastern Mediterranean in general, she was everything he could ask, except in broadside weight of metal. Above all, as he had had the most uncommon good fortune of being able to give her a crew of hand-picked seamen, in which even the afterguard could hand, reef, and steer. There were still many who had not sailed with him before the Worcester, but a surprising proportion of the frigate's 200 men had done so, all the first and second captains of the guns, for example, and nearly all the petty officers. And wherever he looked, he saw faces he knew. Even when they were not old shipmates, he could put a name to them and a character, whereas in the Worcester far too many had been anonymous. And he observed that they looked remarkably cheerful, as though his own good humour had spread. Certainly they had just had their grog, and the weather was fine, and this was a peaceful make-and-mend afternoon. But even so he had rarely seen a more cheerful crew, particularly the old Surprises.
"A surprising proportion of old Surprises," he said to himself, and chuckled.
"The skipper's luck is in," murmured Bondon,
as he sat on the gangway, embroidering Surprise on the ribbon of his shore-going hat.
"Well, I hope so, I'm sure," said his heavy cousin Joe. "It's been out long enough.
"Get your great ass off my new shirt, you whoreson lobster," he said mildly to his other neighbour, a marine. "I only hope it's not come in too hearty, that's all," said Bondon, reaching out for the solid wooden truck of Number 8 Gun's carriage. Joe nodded. Although he was a heavy man, he perfectly grasped the meaning of Bondon's luck. It was not chance, commonplace good fortune, far from it, but a different concept altogether, one of an almost religious nature, like the favour of some god, or even, in extreme cases, like possession. And if it came in too hearty, it might prove fatal, too fiery an embrace entirely. In any event, it had to be treated with great respect, rarely named, referred to by allusion or alias, never explained. There was no clear, necessary connection with moral worth, nor with beauty, but its possessors were generally well-liked men and tolerably good-looking, and it was often seen to go with a particular kind of happiness. It was this quality, much more than his prizes, the perceived cause rather than the effect, that had made the lower deck speak of lucky Jack Aubrey early in his career, and it was a piety at the same old heathen level that now made Bondon deprecate any excess. Captain Aubrey, staring out over the weather rail, smiling as he recalled the simple fun he had had in this same ship as a boy, heard the crunch of the marine drummer's boots coming aft. He cast a last automatic glance at the dog vane, said,
"Very well, Dice," to the helmsman,
went below for his best neckcloth, and put it on while the drum beat "Roast Beef of Old England." Then, bending low under the beams, he walked into the gunroom just as Pullings took up his station at the door to welcome him.
"Come, this is altogether snugger and more homely," said Jack,
smiling at the friendly faces, eight of them, tight-packed round the gunroom table. And homely it was for those brought up in sea-going slums, though perhaps a little snugger than could have been wished, since each had his servant behind his chair, and since the day was uncommonly warm and still, with no air coming below. The fare was homely, too, the main dish being the roast beef of old Calabria, a great piece of one of those Italian buffaloes known as grey friars in the navy, and shipped to Malta when they were quite past work, and this was followed by figgy dowdy.
"Now that is what I call a really good basis for literature," said Jack,
when the cloth had been drawn, the king's health drunk, and fresh decanters set upon the table.
"When is the sweepstake to begin?"
"Directly, sir," said Pullings. "Thompson, pass round the voting papers, place the ballot box, collect the stakes, and hand along the glass. We have agreed, sir, that each gentleman is to limit himself to a 4.5-minute glass, that he may explain the rest of the poem in prose, speaking quick. And we have agreed, sir, that there is to be no applause, nor no catcalls, for fear of influencing the vote. It is all to be as fair as habeas corpus."
"Or nunc dimittis," said the bursar.
But although Mr. Adams had been very active in framing the rules, he and others turned shy at the last moment, and the pearly nautilus passed round for the stakes, held only a half guinea, an assortment of English silver, and 3 pieces of 8, the contribution of the remaining competitors, Mowat, Rowan, and Driver, the new marine officer shipped at Malta, a very ample, pink, amiable young man with weak eyes and a way of chuckling to himself. His powers were as yet unknown to the gunroom. They drew lots, and Rowan began.
"Now, gentlemen," he said, speaking quick and in prose, "this is part of a poem about the Courageux, Captain Wilkinson, running plumb on to the Anholt Reef by night. Wind at southwest, double-reefed topsails and forecourse, making 8 knots. Turn the glass."
Pullings turned the sand glass, and without the slightest change of tone or pace, or the least concession to the conventions of recital, Rowan went straight on, his jolly round face beaming on the company.
"Dismal was this, many did despair that her dissolution was very near. She thumped heavy and masts did play, that in their obedience to the prow would jump away. Awful, the grinding noise of keel and heel with an unusual motion made the crew to reel, the rudder being most oppressed and bound, but soon it got released and went to the ground. Sail first being set to press her over the reef, but striking harder without relief, 'twas instantly chewed up and fasted again anew with willingness and zeal by her gallant crew. At last the deleterious order to prepare to throw the cannon overboard. Oh, what despair! The officer of the 3rd post ventured to state, 'Oh, noble chieftain, pray hesitate.' 'I happen to have the watch, sir,' he said in an aside to Jack. 'Remember, sire,' said this selfsame 3rd with due submission, 'pray let me be heard, your own experiences of its baleful effects, as often tried and as often made wrecks. guns lying together on the sand equal to rocks annoy the bottom of the bark they may soon destroy. Now it's blowing a gale of wind, what hopes impossible to save our lives could we get out the boats? Stand fast, the bold commander said. 'Tis true, the wind has shifted for us, set topsails anew, square sail set and braced all back. See hence the wonderful care of Almighty's providence.
In spite of the rules, there was a distinct murmur of approval at the ship's coming off, for it was clearly understood from Rowan's expression, and indeed from his presence among them, that the Courageux had come off. But there was an even more distinct expression of scepticism about the third lieutenant's words to his captain, Wilkinson being a testy gentleman. Rowan felt this and observed, "The piece about noble chieftain is poetic, you understand?"
"I never thought you would bring her off in time," said Pullings. "There were not above 3 grains of sand left. Next."
Mowat took a draught of port, turned a little pale, and said, "My piece is a fragment too, part of something in the epical line in 3 cantos about people sailing in these waters, or to be more exact, somewhat more easterly, off Cape Spardo. They run into dirty weather, furl topsails, send down to gallant yards, and then reef courses, and this is a description of the manoeuvre. But it is preceded by a simile that I rather flatter myself, by a simile that would fall into place better if I went back to, now to the north, from Afric's burning shore, a troop of porpoises their course explore. But I doubt I could get all that in, and it may seem a little strange without, but anyway, here goes." He nodded to Pullings to turn the glass, and with his eyes fixed on the falling sand, he began in a hollow, moaning voice, "Tossed on the tide, she feels the tempest blow, and dreads the vengeance of so fell a foe as the proud horse, with costly trappings gay, exulting, prances to the bloody fray. Spurning the ground, he glories in his might, but reels tumultuous in the shock of fight. Even so, caparisoned in gaudy pride, the bounding vessel dances on the tide." He looked quickly round for some reaction to his simile. He saw nothing but deep, universal stupidity, but this may only have been the reserve called for by the rules. In any case, he hurried on to ground where everybody would be more at home. "Fierce and more fierce the southern demon blew, and more incensed the roaring waters grew. The ship no longer can her topsails spread, and every hope of fairer skies is fled. Bowlines and halyards are relaxed again, clewlines hauled down, and sheets let fly amain. Clued up each topsail, and by braces squared, the seamen climb aloft on either yard. They furled the sails and pointed to the wind, the yard by rolling tackles then confined. While o'er the ship the gallant boatswain flies, like a hoarse mastiff through the storm he cries. Prompt to direct the unskilful still appears, the expert he praises, and the fearful cheers. Now some to strike to gallant yards attend, some travellers up the weather backstays send. At each masthead the top ropes others bend. The youngest sailors from the yards above their parrels lifts and braces soon remove, then topped an end and to the travellers tied, charged with their sails they down the backstays slide. Their sails reduced and all the rigging clear, a while the crew relax from toils severe. But then it gets worse, said Mowat, and the sun goes down. I skip the sunset, such a shame. I skip the moon and stars. The ship no longer can her courses bear. To reef the courses is the master's care. The sailors summoned aft, a daring band, attend the enfolding brails at his command. But he who strives the tempest to disarm will never first embrail the lee yardarm. So to windward and obedient to command, to raise the tack the ready sailors stand. The sheet and weather brace they then stand by, the lee clue garnet and the buntlands ply. Thus all prepared, let go the sheet, he cries. Impetuous
time, cried Pullings.
Oh, Tom, said Mowat, sinking in his chair, his afflatus gone. I am sorry, old fellow, said Pullings, but fair's fair, you know, and the Royal Marines must have their whack.
Mr. Driver, always pink, was now the colour of his uniform coat, but whether this was port or confusion, or the heat, could not yet be determined. He gave the gunroom to understand that his poem was not a fragment, oh no, not a piece of anything larger, if they understood him, but a whole complete in itself, as he might say. By listening attentively, they gathered that it was a cove thinking of getting married. Advice to this cove from a knowing friend, a deep old file that had seen a thing or two in his time. But Mr. Driver chuckled so extremely and spoke in so low and bumbling a voice, hanging his head, that they missed almost everything until,
"A person amiable, straight, and free from natural or chance deformity, let not her years exceed, if equal thine, for women past their vigour soon decline, her fortune competent, and if thy sight can reach so far, take care 'tis gathered right. If thine's enough, then hers may be the less.
Do not aspire to riches in excess, for that which makes our lives delightful prove is a genteel sufficiency and love."
"Very good," cried the purser, as he wrote on his voting paper.
"Tell me, sir, what would you reckon a genteel sufficiency?
Supposing, I mean, a man only had his pay." Mr. Driver laughed and wheezed, and at last brought out, "200 a year in the funds at her own disposal." "No remarks, gentlemen, if you please," said Pullings, shaking his head at Professor Graham, who was obviously about to speak. "No remarks before the voting." He passed round the ballot box, a sextant case on this occasion, set it down, filled, in front of Jack, and said to Graham,
"I cut you short, sir. I beg your pardon."
"I was only going to observe that Captain Driver's poem reminded me of Pomfret's 'To his friend inclined to marry.'"
"But it is Pomfret's 'To his friend,'" said Driver, surprised. And amidst the general outcry, he could be heard to say, "My guardian made me get it by rote." Battered on all sides, he appealed to Jack.
"How could a man have been expected to guess that it was to be original poetry? Original poetry, for God's sake! He had supposed it was to be a prize for elegant delivery."
"Had it been a prize for elegant delivery," said Jack, "I dare say Mr. Driver would have borne the bell away, but as things are, he must be scratched and given back his stake, and the ballots in his favour do not count. As for the remaining competitors," he said, examining the votes, "I find that Mr. Rowan carries the day as far as poetry in the classical manner is concerned, whereas Mr. Mowat wins for poetry in the modern style. The prize is therefore divided into two equal halves, or moieties, and I think I do not misinterpret the company's sentiments when I urge both gentlemen to enter into contact with some respectable bookseller with a view to the publication of their works, both for the gratification of their friends and for the benefit of the service."
"Hear him, hear him," cried the rest of the gunroom, beating on the table.
"Murray is the man," said Graham, with a significant look. "John Murray, of Albemarle Street. He has an excellent reputation, and I may observe, for the credit of the booksellers, that his father, who founded the shop, was the son, the legitimate son, of a lieutenant in the Marines."
Mr. Driver did not seem at all pleased. He said that if a cove had a son with no talent of any kind and no presence or personal beauty, then the cove was quite justified in putting him to a shop. The family was not obliged to take notice of him after he grew up, unless he made himself an estate, or at least a more than usually genteel competence. And anyhow, a bookseller was not a common shopkeeper. Many that Driver knew could read and write, and some spoke quite pretty.
"Just so," said Graham. "And this Mr. Murray is a particularly well-conducted example. Furthermore, he is comparatively free from the sordid parsimony that has brought the trade, as it is emphatically called, so unenviable a reputation. I am told that he gave £500, £500, gentlemen, for the first part of Lord Byron's Childe Harold."
"Heavens," said Stephen, "what would the adult Harold have fetched entire?"
"Child is an archaic term for a young man of good family," said Graham.
"I should not expect so much," said Rowan, "not being a lord, but I should like to see my piece in print."
In the evening, when the frigate was sailing very slowly into a mist that rose from the warm surface of the sea, a mist deeply tinged with rose from the setting sun, Jack said,
"I cannot tell you how happy I am to be in the dear Surprise again."
"So I see," said Stephen, "and I give you joy of it."
He spoke a little shortly. The end of his cello bow had just come to pieces in his hand, and irritation was boiling up within. In Malta he had lain ashore, and Maltese bedbugs, fleas, and mosquitoes had bitten him extremely, so that even now he itched from head to foot, and felt far hotter than he found agreeable. He was not positively malignant, however, and he considered his friend attentively. Had Jack made some amorous conquest in Valletta, or rather, Jack being less enterprising than Babington, had some odious wench led him by guile, by gentle force, to a pagan altar, persuading him that it was he the conquering hero? No, the look was not quite right for that.
It had nothing of male self-complacency. Yet it was some heathen state of grace, he was sure, and when Jack, tucking his fiddle under his chin, struck out a strange leaping phrase, and then began to improvise upon it, he was surer still. What with his self-taught technique and various wounds, Jack could never be a very good player, but this evening he was making his fiddle sing so that it was a joy to hear. It was a wild, irregular song, expressing glee rather than any respect for rules, but a glee that was very, very far from being puerile. And contemplating Jack as he played away there by the stern window, Stephen wondered that a 16-stone post-captain, a scarred and battled gentleman with an incipient dewlap, could skip with such subtle grace, could possess such gaiety, could conceive such surprisingly witty and original concepts, and could express them so well. The dinner-table Jack Aubrey, delighted with a pun, was a different being, yet the two lived in the same skin together. The cello bow was mended, the violin improvisation ended with an elfin shriek trilling up almost beyond the limit of human hearing, and they set to their old well-paced Scarlatti in C major, playing on into the middle watch. "Will William Babington have remembered my mastic?" I asked myself, said Stephen as they parted. "He is a worthy young man, but the sight of a smock drives all other considerations from his mind, and Argostoli is renowned not only for mastic, but also for handsome women."
"I am sure he will have remembered it," said Jack, "but I doubt we meet him in the morning. Even we are making barely 2 knots, and that poor misbegotten rig, that Dutch tub of a dryad, is no use in light airs. Besides, if this mist don't clear tomorrow, we may be becalmed altogether."
Stephen had the utmost faith in Jack as a weather prophet, a mariner, and a sea pope, but it so happened that his bites and the lack of air— the Worcester's luxurious 20 square feet had made him forget the dank, unventilated crib under the Surprise's waterline, prevented him from sleeping. He was on deck at first dawn, when the pale mists were thinning and the hand-pumps wheezing up the water of the ritual scouring, and when the lookout called, "Sail ho! Sail on the larboard bow!" he looked in the right direction, saw the sail in question looming vaguely, but not so vaguely that he could not tell she was a brig, and said,
"Fallible! Fallible Jack Aubrey! I shall have my mastic after all."
With this he walked forward, scratching himself. He picked his way among the sand and water sprinklers and passed the mate of the watch, who, perched on a carronade with his trousers rolled against the wet, was staring at the ghostly brig. Stephen said,
"There is Mr. Babington. Perhaps he will come to breakfast."
But the youth, still staring, only answered with a vacant laugh. Stephen walked on as far as the starboard forechains, took off his nightcap and nightshirt, stuffed them under the dead eyes, scratched himself industriously for a while, crept out onto the projecting shelf, and holding his nose with his left hand, crossing himself with his right, dropped with tightly shut eyes into the sea, the infinitely refreshing sea. He was not a powerful swimmer. Indeed, by ordinary standards, he could hardly be called a swimmer at all, but with infinite pains Jack had taught him to keep afloat, and beat his way through the water as far as 50 and even 60 yards at a time. His journey along the ship's side from the forechains to the boat, towing astern, was therefore well within his powers, particularly as the ship herself was in gentle forward motion, which made his relative progress towards the boat so much the faster. It was without the slightest apprehension, then, that he plunged, although he had never done so alone before, and even as the bubbles rushed past his ears he thought,
"I shall say to Jack, ha, ha, I went a-swimming this morning," and watch his amazement.
But as he came to the surface, gasping and clearing the water from his eyes, he saw that the ship's side was strangely far from him. Almost at once he realized that she was turning to larboard, and he struck out with all his might, uttering a howl each time a wave lifted his head well clear of the water. But all hands had been called, and there was a great deal of piping and shouting and running about on board the Surprise as she continued her turn, packing on sail after sail as she did so. And since all those who had a moment to look away from the task in hand stared eagerly to larboard, it was only by a singular piece of good fortune that John Newby, turning to spit over the starboard rail, caught sight of his anguished face. From about this point the exact sequence of events escaped him. He was conscious of swallowing a great deal of sea-water, and then of sinking for a while,
and then of finding that he had lost his direction as well as his strength and what little buoyancy he ever had. But soon he seemed to be in a perpetual agitated present, in which things happened not in a given order, but on different planes. The enormous voice that cried, "Back the foretopsail!" high above his head, the renewed sinking into the depths, dark now from the shadow of the hull, the rough hands that grasped his ear, elbow, and left heel, dragging him over the gunwale of a boat, and the midshipman's anxious, "Are you all right, sir?" might all have been contemporary. It was not until he had pondered for a while, gasping in the stern sheets, that occurrences took to following one another, so that,
stretch out, for God's sake,"
preceded the thump of the boat against the ship's side, and the call for a line to be handed down. But he was quite himself by the time he heard, not without anxiety, bow oar's confidential murmur to his neighbour of, "He won't half cop it if the skipper misses of this prize by reason of his topping it, the grampus." Bonden, almost speechless with indignation, bundled him up the side, and plucking at him like an angry nanny would have urged him below. But Stephen dodged under his arm and walked forward to where Captain Aubrey was standing by the larboard bow-chaser with Pullings and the gunner, while the gun's crew trained the beautifully long brass 9-pounder on the flying brig, now half a mile away and under a perfect cloud of canvas. All but Jack looked quickly away, adopting wooden, vacant expressions, as he came up and said,
"Good morning, sir. I beg your pardon for causing this disturbance. I was a-swimming."
"Good morning, Doctor," said Jack with a cold glance. "I was not aware that you were in the sea until the boat was beside you, thanks to Mr. Calamy's presence of mind. But I must remind you that no one is allowed to leave the ship without permission. Furthermore, this is not a proper dress in which to appear on deck. We will speak of this matter at a more suitable time. At present, I desire you will go to your cabin. Master Gunner, lend the doctor your apron. Lay me the roundest shot in this garland, load with 3¼ pound and 2 wads, and let us try the range."
In his cabin, Stephen heard the gun open a deliberate, careful fire. He felt cold and depressed. On his way below, he had met nothing but disapproving looks, and when he called for his servant, there was no reply. If it had not been for this vile prize, for the possibility of this vile prize, if it had not been for their greed, their grovelling cupidity, he would have been surrounded with loving care. He would have been caressed on all hands and congratulated on his escape. Wrapping himself in a blanket, he dropped into an improbable doze, then deeper, deeper, into a profound insensibility from which he was shaken, violently shaken, by Peter Calamy, who told him in a shrill bellow that, "Oh, Borrell had cut her main topsail halyards away at 1,000 yards. All came down with a run. Lord, how they had roared! She was alongside now, and the captain thought he might like to have a look at her." Ever since Dr. Maturin had treated him for mumps, Calamy had grown very fond of him. This affection expressed itself by an odd, confidential address. When, for example, Mr. Calamy was to dine in the cabin, he would take Stephen aside early in the day and say, "What's going to be for pudding, sir?" "Oh, come on, sir, I'm sure you know what's for pudding." And by the assumption that in many respects he was the older of the two, an assumption much strengthened by this morning's events. He now compelled Stephen into quite formal clothes.
"No, sir, breeches it must be. The captain may only be wearing trousers, but after this morning, breeches and a frilled shirt is the least that can be expected."
It was in something not very far from full dress, therefore, that Dr. Maturin regained the deck, a deck now crowded with benevolent, smiling faces.
"There you are, Doctor," said Jack, shaking his hand. "I thought you might like to see our prize before I send her away."
He led him to the side, and they looked down on the captured brig. Not indeed the Dryad, nor anything resembling the Dryad, except in the possession of 2 masts, but a genuine flyer, long and narrow, with a very fine entry, towering masts, and a bowsprit of extraordinary length, and a triple dolphin striker. The Bonhomme Richard, that well-known blockade runner.
"Whether we should have caught her by the end of the day, with the breeze freshening, I do not know," said Jack. "But Mr. Borrell here made sure of it with a ball that cut away her topsail halyards at 1,000 yards. Such a pretty shot."
"It was mostly luck, sir," said the gunner, laughing with delight.
"As you will recall," said Jack, "the halyards are the ropes that haul the yards up, so when they are cut, the yards fall down. Unless they are well puddened, of course, which was not the case," he added.
"There is a great deal of blood on the deck," said Stephen. "Did the falling yard crush many of her men?"
Oh, no, she had already been taken by Greek pirates, their boats pulling aboard her in a dead calm. They killed most of her people, that is where the blood comes from, just keeping her master and a few others for ransom.
Greek pirates, alas? Said Stephen. He had an infinite respect for ancient Greece. The cause of Greek independence was very near to his heart, and in spite of all the evidence to the contrary, he liked to think of modern Greeks in an amiable light. I dare say they are very rare.
Oh, Lord, no! In these waters and eastward, any caique that sees a smaller one turns pirate directly, unless the other is from the same village or the same island, just as everything from the Barbary coast turns corsair whenever the chance offers. In spite of the Turks, they haunt this channel, since it has all the shipping from the Levant to the Adriatic ports. These fellows came up on the Frenchmen in their felucca without a sign of hostility. They hailed one another and passed the time of day, her master tells me. And then in the night, when it fell dead calm, they carried him with their boats, as I say. And when the yard came down, they took to these same boats again and pulled away like fury, keeping the Frenchmen between our guns and them. Do you choose to step over? It is an interesting sight.
The bloody deck was neither new nor interesting, nor were the pillaged cabins and quarters below, but Jack led him down and down into the hold, dim in spite of the open hatches, and extraordinarily aromatic, almost unbreathably scented.
"They have begun breaking bulk, the goddamn fools," said Jack,
and as his eyes grew used to the twilight, Stephen saw that they were walking on nutmegs, cinnamon, cloves, and turmeric spilt from torn bales.
"Is it all spice?" he asked,
pausing by the extraordinary pungency of a cracked pot of musk.
"No," said Jack. "The master tells me that the spice was only his last lading at Scanderoon. The chief of the cargo is indigo, with a few casks of cochineal. But what those vermin were after," he said, referring to the Greeks,
and leading Stephen along the shadowy hold through slanting pillars of scented, dust-filled sunlight,
"and what I am delighted to say they did not have time to carry to their infernal boats, was this."
They turned the corner of a carefully stowed wall of indigo bales, ducking under the shores, and there in a recess lay a heap of silver, a deep, sloping heap of pieces of eight and Maria Theresa dollars that had spilled from an open, tilting chest. By the light of lanterns, two strong ship's boys, guarded by the sergeant of marines and the master-at-arms, were shoveling it into canvas bags. The boys' faces gleamed with sweat and satisfied desire. They and their guardians beamed on the captain.
"That will make a pleasant little distribution," observed Jack.
And as he led the way back to the Surprise, handing Stephen carefully along the catwalk set up for the bags of dollars, he pointed out the flying Greeks. Their boats had reached the felucca, and it was sailing away eastwards under its two lateens, helped by its long, heavy sweeps.
"Shall you pursue them so?" asked Stephen.
"No. If I caught them, I should have to carry them back to Malta to be tried, and I cannot spare the time. If I could deal with them in the Turks' brisk fashion, it would be different. And in any case, I shall give them a gun or two if ever we come within range, which is precious unlikely," said Jack.
And he called,
"Pass the word for Mr. Rowan."
For much of the rest of the watch, he was taken up with the prize, and with giving Rowan, the prize master, very serious advice about his course and conduct. Then, just after eight bells,
"Where away?"
he called, in answer to the lookout's cry of a sail.
"Broad on the starboard beam, sir! A brig! Ha, ha, ha!"
It was rare for merry laughter to accompany replies in a ship under Captain Aubrey's command, but this was an uncommon day, and in any event it was clear from the lookout's satirical tone and his mirth, and from the brig's bearing, that this must be the unfortunate Dryad. Unfortunate, in that a slightly earlier appearance would have earned her a share in this fine, plump prize. If she had even been on the horizon during the chase, she must have shared, and the Surprises, to a man, were heartily glad that she had been delayed.
"You will get your mastic at last," said Jack, laughing too. "But poor Babington will be as blue as a Barbary ape. Still, he has only himself to blame. I always told him as a boy to waste not a minute. Ha, ha, ha! Mr. Pullings, when the clerk is ready, we will muster by the open list."
This was not a regular day for mustering. The Surprises had neither clean shirts nor shaved faces, and although some made an effort to look trim, replaiting their pigtails and putting on their best blue jackets, most came straight from their work on the prize's damaged rigging. They all looked very cheerful, however, and at the boatswain's pipe they formed their usual irregular mass on the larboard side of the quarterdeck and along the gangway in a high state of expectant greed, for it was seen that Mr. Ward, the captain's clerk, had taken up his station by the capstan rather than just forward of the wheel, and that there were several sailcloth bags at his feet, and all those who had sailed with Captain Aubrey before knew his habit of circumventing the Admiralty courts and their long, long delays.
"Silence fore and aft!" called Pullings, and turning to Jack, he said, "All present, clean and sober, sir, if you please."
"Thank you, Mr. Pullings," said Jack. "Then we will muster by the open list."
He raised his voice.
"Listen, men! There was some silver in the Frenchman, so rather than wait 6 months for the prize court, we will have a first distribution now. Carry on, Mr. Ward."
"Abraham Whitsover," called the clerk, and Abraham Whitsover pushed his way out of the throng, crossed the deck, saluted his captain, had his name checked on the roll, and received, paid down on the capstan head, $25, the equivalent of 3 months' pay, which he put into his hat, moving over to the starboard gangway, chuckling to himself. It was necessarily a long muster, though a satisfying one, and before it was over the dryad had drawn so close with the freshening breeze that even without his telescope Jack could see what looked very like a group of women right aft. With his telescope he saw that it was quite certainly women, clustered about the dryad's captain. Another parcel, somewhat larger, stood near the mainmast, presumably surrounding the dryad's officers, while a female crowd lined the rail as far as the bows, among the hands. He had known women put off to a man-of-war coming into port in such numbers that the ship would settle a strake under their weight, but such proportions as this, more women than foremast jacks, he had never beheld, even in the most licentious ships and on the West Indies station, and this was at sea, on active service. The last man crossed the deck. The clinking ship's company was dismissed, and Jack said to the signal midshipman,
"To Dryad, captain, repair aboard at once."
He then turned to Rowan and said,
"You may part company as soon as I hear from Captain Babington whether the transports are in Cephalonia or not. Then you will not lose a moment of this beautiful leading breeze. Here he is. Captain Babington, good day to you. Are the transports in Cephalonia? Is all well?"
"Yes, sir."
"Mr. Rowan, report to the Commander-in-Chief with my duty that the transports are in Cephalonia, and that all is well. You need not mention the fact that you saw one of the squadron crammed with women from head to stern. You need not report this open, and I may say shameless, violation of the Articles of War, for that disagreeable task falls to your superiors. Nor need you make any observations about floating brothels or the relaxation of discipline in the warmer eastern waters, for these observations will naturally occur to the Commander-in-Chief without your help. Now pray go aboard our prize, and proceed to Malta without the loss of a minute. Not all of us can spare the time to dally with the sex."
"Oh, sir!" cried Babington, as Rowan darted over the side. "I really must be allowed to protest, to deny—"
"You will not deny that they are women, surely. I can tell the difference between Adam and Eve as quick as the next man, even if you cannot, just as I can tell the difference between an active, zealous officer and a lubber that lies in port indulging his whims. It is of no use trying to impose upon me."
"No, sir, but these are all respectable women."
"And why are they leering over the side like that and making gestures?"
"It is only their way, sir. They are all lesbians."
"And no doubt they are all parsons' daughters, your cousins in the third degree, like that wench in Ceylon.
And lesbians always join their hands like that, to show respect."
"You are becoming an authority on the motions of Greek women, it appears."
"Oh, sir," cried Babington, his voice growing shriller still, "I know you do not like women aboard."
"I believe I have had occasion to mention it to you some 50 or 60 times in the last 10 years.
"But if you will allow me to explain—"
"It would be interesting to hear how the presence of 38 young women in one of His Majesty's sloops can be explained. But since I like some decency to be preserved on my quarter-deck, perhaps the explanation had better take place in the cabin."
And in the cabin he said,
"Upon my word, William, this is coming it pretty high. 38 wenches at a time is coming it pretty high."
"So it would be, sir, if there were any guilty or even, shall I say, cheerful intent. But upon my honour I am blameless in thought, word and deed. Well, in word and deed, anyhow."
"Perhaps you had better begin the explanation."
"Well, sir, as soon as I had seen the transports into Argostoli, I shaped a course for the Strophades, and towards the end of the day we sighted a sail far to leeward, flying signals of distress. She proved to be a Tunis corsair that had been dismasted in a squall and had run clean out of water, having so many prisoners aboard. She had been raiding the islands for women, and she had done far better than she expected, chanced upon a kind of sewing bee on the shore at Naxos, and then all the young female part of a wedding in Lesbos, taken as they were crossing Paramo Harbour in boats.
"The dogs," said Jack. "So these are the women?"
"Not all of them, sir," said Babington. "We told the Moors, of course, that the Christians must be given up, in the nature of things, and we told the women that they should be taken back to Greece. But then it appeared that those from Naxos, who had been aboard quite a long time, did not want to be parted from their corsairs, whereas those from Lesbos did. They were absolutely passionate about going home. We could not quite make it out at first, but presently the Naxiotes and the Lesbians started calling names and pulling one another's hair, and everything became quite clear. So we separated them as gently as we could. My boatswain was bitten to the bone, and several hands cruelly scratched, helped the Moors set up a jury-mast, gave them biscuit and water enough to carry them home, and made all possible sail to join you at the rendezvous. And here I am, sir, quite happy to be publicly reproached, abused, and amazingly vilified, so long as I am conscious of having done my duty."
"Well, damn me, William, I am sorry. I am very sorry, indeed I am. But injustice is a rule of the service, as you know very well, and since you have to have a good deal of undeserved abuse, you might just as well have it from your friends."
"Certainly, sir. And now, sir, what must I do?"
"You must drink a few glasses of Madeira, and then you must turn about while the wind serves and take all your pretty creatures, your Virgos intactos, I am sure, to Cephalonia and entrust them to Major de Bosse, the governor. He is an uncommon, energetic, reliable officer and understands the Greek. He will look after them, victualling them on the shore establishment until he finds a good, stolid trader going to Lesbos. Killick!" he called, raising his voice from habit, although his steward could be heard breathing heavily on the other side of the bulkhead, eavesdropping as usual. "Killick! Light along some Madeira and ask the doctor and Mr. Pullings if they would like to step below."
"I must tell the doctor of a prodigious kind of pelican that flew over us off Zante," said Babington. "And I must not forget the Turkish frigate we saw not long before I met you. She gave us a civil gun when we showed our colours, and I returned it. But we did not speak, because she was chasing a felucca to leeward, cracking on most surprising for a Turk, stunsails aloft and alow on either side." "The Turkish frigate," said Professor Graham, who had a recent list of the Sultan's men of war, "was the Turgud of 30 guns. She and the Kitabi of 20 guns, together with a few smaller things, constituted the command of Mustafa, the ruler of Karya, and the Capitan Bey, or senior naval officer in these waters. Indeed, they might be said to belong to Mustafa himself, since he used them just as he saw fit, without any reference to Constantinople. And this was fair enough, since Constantinople never produced the men's wages, and Mustafa was obliged to feed and pay them himself. He was said, however, to be an active, zealous officer, and after they had been sailing an hour or two, with the mainland of Epirus looming high and jagged ahead, and the Bonhomme Richard and the Dryad lost to view long since, they came across signs of his activity and zeal. The charred remains of a felucca, shattered by gunfire, but still just awash and still just recognisable. Then, perfectly recognisable, 20 or 30 corpses drifting in a line along the current. All Greek, all stripped, some headless, some with their throats cut, some impaled, and 3 roughly crucified, St. Andrew fashion, on the felucca's broken sweeps.